Randy Mosher joins me to discuss the elusive flavors of lager yeast. This is Beersmith Podcast number 254.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 254, and it's late March 2022. Randy Mosher joins me this week to discuss the elusive flavors of lager yeast. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And the web-based version of Beersmith with a new inventory module is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you edit, brew, and build recipes from your browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. The web version gives you access to tens of thousands of recipes, online recipe editing, advanced water tools, and much more. You can try Beersmith Web for 30 days by setting up an account at beersmithrecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get Beersmith Web and the desktop version for one low price. Check out beersmithrecipes.com to give Beersmith Web a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Randy Mosher. Randy is the author of the books Mastering Homebrew, Radical Brewing, and Tasting Beer. He's also a partner in two breweries near Chicago, Five Rabbit and Forbidden Root. Randy, it's always a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Yeah, great to be here, Brad. Always love talking about beer.
So how are you doing? I think you said you got some interesting things going on at Five Rabbit and Forbidden Root.
Yeah, Five Rabbit. We because of COVID, we really were kind of struggling to get through that, and we eventually shut down our production brewery, and we're in the process of getting a brew pub built in a neighborhood called Pilsen on the near south side. That's a real important Mexican, really kind of the heart of the Mexican community.
So change of venue, and I think you mentioned it, your brewery has a Hispanic tilt to it, right?
We are a Latin American brewery. My partner's from Costa Rica, his wife's from Peru, and we have, you know, investors from Mexico and elsewhere. So and then Forbidden Root's doing well. We're kind of bouncing back from COVID. We managed to get through the shutdown days and stayed open and sold a lot of beer to go and did online beer dinners and stuff. But we're on our third location right now, two in Chicago and one in Columbus, Ohio.
And, oh, so you have three now, huh?
We have three. Yeah. We opened, we took over another defunct brew pub on the north side of Chicago around Thanksgiving last year, and got a killer chef in there. We just got on the Chicago Tribune, best bar food category in their People's Choice Awards, so we're pretty thrilled about that.
Oh, congratulations! That's awesome.
So we're rocking it.
For people that happen to be in Chicago, where are they located?
One's at Chicago Avenue, which is pretty near to downtown, and the other one's at sort of between at the edge of Ravenswood and Lincoln Square neighborhoods on Lawrence Avenue, or off of Lawrence Avenue on Ravenswood.
I think Forbidden Root has a little bit more of a classic craft style menu, right?
In terms of the beer.
The beer, yeah.
Well, we're doing what we're calling botanical brewing. Mm-hmm. We're doing a mix of things as you have to do. We like the hazy IPAs. We've got always got some lagers going. Sometimes we'll put a little oak in them or do something a little bit not quite traditional with them. And then we've got a whole variety of farmhousey and saison-like beers, and we do beers with we always have some fruit beers going, some tart fruit ales usually, so it's pretty wide spectrum. I mean, you got to keep quite a variety going at a brew pub these days. So,
yeah, and I imagine IPAs and hazy IPAs probably still the top sellers, though, right?
Typically, either that or what we call a yellow beer. It depends. You know, it's one or the other of those because people, you know, everybody likes a good pale lager or golden ale. So, we've got a strawberry basil Hefeweizen that's one of our big sellers. It's certainly our biggest seller out in the market. So,
awesome. Well, yep. Today you actually wanted to talk about lager yeast. And I think you wrote an article recently on the elusive nature of lager yeast. What makes lager yeast so elusive?
So lager yeast is elusive for a lot of different reasons. First of all, the story is a little bit confusing about how it began. You know, there's talk about monks fermenting in caves in the Alps and all this crazy stuff. As near as we know, around 1550, there was an edict that was put out that forbade the brewing of beers in the summer and really kept it between, I think, September and April mm-hmm. as the proper brewing season. And so this meant that the beers, presumably they made small beer all year round, but that the serious beers were fermented under winter conditions, being kind of cool conditions, mm-hmm. cool or cold, because think about 1500s, there wasn't a lot of central heat. You know, the brew kettle would have been like the heat, and there would have been maybe some heat in the office or whatever, but the fermentation areas were minimally heated, I suspect. And so over time, a very interesting yeast, which they have recently determined was a hybrid with a specific Saccharomyces strain called Sac Bayanus, whose home range was identified in Patagonia. But there's another population of it in the Northern Hemisphere, pretty much everywhere but Europe. So it's still a little bit of a mystery how that beer got into the tanks. And that hybridization event apparently occurred long before the beginning of human history, written history. So the yeast was kicking around doing we don't know what. Mm-hmm. So the other thing is that lager itself is sort of not something you put into your beer because you want the yeast to flavor your beer like we do with ale. Lager yeast you use in a beer because you want to highlight the nature of the ingredients themselves and have the yeast kind of do a minimal amount of addition.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I was just saying it really is, you know, you're trying to highlight the hops, the malt and all the other flavors, not necessarily the lager yeast itself.
Right. Yeah. And that's the general thing about yeast is that you're going to have a much more neutral kind of flavor, which means that thinking about it and choosing it and all of that becomes a little bit more complicated. If you're thinking about top fermenting yeast strains, you're making an English beer, pretty much want to use an English yeast because those have certain characteristics that if you're trying to go for a great best bitter or something like that, you're not going to get that out of a Belgian, for example.
Right.
You know, and vice versa. Belgian yeast brings so much to a beer, a lot of phenolic characters, tons of esters. So, you know, and you can choose from a whole spectrum that have been harvested really from beers that you know, from Trappist beers and Strong Goldens and things like that. So you have it's pretty easy to pick them out by style. Whereas lager gets a lot more complicated in terms of making those choices. And a lot of it is often driven by what your fermentation process needs are, you know, are you fermenting in large tanks? Are you fermenting strong worts? You know, so it's almost easier to make those decisions by that. And the other thing is that back in the 1890s, everybody was brewing with tanks that just had mixed cultures in them. And even though they were kind of probably more or less similar strains, and there may have been a dominant one and a couple others, we don't really know. Because around that time, at the Carlsberg Brewery, that by Christian Emil Hansen, the famous... scientist who had worked under Louis Pasteur isolated a pure lager strain. And then that was done a few years later at Heineken. And for whatever reason, they didn't isolate dozens of strains and keep them all. There really were just these two strains, the one that was isolated at Heineken and the one that was isolated in Carlsberg. And those, we think, pretty sure, have given rise to a type 1 strain and a type 2 strain. Hmm. And among those, all lager yeasts, like as far as we know, because this gets complicated when you start doing genome sequencing and things, it's really quite complex.
Yeah, that's what we used to think. There was like ale yeast and lager yeast right now, but genetics has really taught us that the picture is a lot more complicated than that, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and the yeast, I mean, the yeasts are really quite amazing. You know, we think about yeast as being simple like a bacteria. And of course, even bacteria are really complicated, but yeast are more closely related to human beings than it is to either bacteria or plants, right? So yeast are used in physiology as a model cell when they're studying cellular processes for mammals and humans, even though there's obviously quite a bit of differences there in terms of the cellular structure and the little organelles that are inside the cells and generally how they work. It's more or less the same type of physiology that we have. And so one of the things that you find in the cultured yeast, both in ale yeast and in lager yeast, is you have multiple copies of the genome, right? So instead of just a single copy of a genome, there was first some kind of dividing event where yeast acquired two copies. And then we see with lager yeast, there's a whole group of it that has three copies. And then there's another group that has four copies. And this is a patchwork. One of the research papers called it a mosaic of genomes. And so, in science, everything is a wormhole. And so you just start looking at it and you get deeper and deeper in this incredibly complicated world of trying to sort this out. And
Chris White was talking to me a while back about there's all these hybrid yeasts that have both some sour characteristic to them and traditional yeast characteristic to them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's a thing that, you know, they understand enough about gene editing and hybridization and things like that, that there's a lot of manipulation going on. One of the things that's kind of exciting is that people are starting to look at the this hybrid strain or the strain that got in that was one of the hybrids, one of the parts of lager yeast, and fermenting beer with that, and looking at some of the other cold tolerant species of Saccharomyces, of which there are several, and some of them appears that they can make pretty decent beer.
You talked a few minutes ago about the history of lager strains, and I think you mentioned that lager started in Bavaria. But it's interesting, even in the time before, you know, Louis Pasteur and understanding even what yeast was, these had been kind of isolated to the point where, and reused to the point where there were really only two strains in use, right?
Well, we don't know because they weren't really isolated at the time. We know that in the 1890s, they isolated the type 1 strain, which is a more or less a Bohemian strain. That was a Carlsberg strain. And then a few years later, they isolated the Heineken strain, which had come from another Danish brewery called Tuborg, and really was widely in use in Bavaria. But some of the Bohemian strains were in use down there. I mean, and even I remember when I was at Pilsner Urquell back in the would have been the 1990s, they were still fermenting with three different strains separately and then blending the beer together. So
interesting.
And I know that those strains have been typed and studied, and I don't really have any revelations about them, but because again, it gets all so complicated. And the other thing that's really a problem for people trying to sort all this out is that the strains that are most circulated are quite proprietary, and especially the ones that are used now for mass market lager production, like the Coors strain and the Miller strain and the Anheuser-Busch strain, and So it's very difficult to find scientific papers that identify strains that are brewery specific. You know, they generally, like, all, there's been a lot of this genome sequencing work done pretty recently, you know, that Chris, I'm sure, talked to you about. Yeah. That started maybe, I don't know, 5-6 years ago or so, whenever that was. And, you know, the problem is that we don't really know. We know what they sequenced, but they kept the code numbers kind of secret. So it's really a little bit difficult. You know, you have to read between the lines sometimes and figure out, like, what this could possibly be. So there, people have done that on the internet a little bit, but we still don't have, like, one good, clear picture of what's what.
So, but going back to the history, we believe that the lagers first originated, what, in the 1500s, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, you see references to lager beer earlier, but definitively, you know, yeah, 1500s is where everybody kind of comes down right now. It's interesting because the prohibition on cold weather brewing didn't only apply in Bavaria, mm-hmm. But it applied in Belgium and some other places in the north of Europe, because everybody recognized beer that's brewed that isn't for quick sale in the summer is not going to be very good, you know, because there was a lot of, the breweries were out in the, you know, there was a lot of horses around. There was a lot of horse poop dust flying around in the air. And just the general microbial load in the summer, plus elevated temperatures, none of that's good for beer.
And no storage, really. No cold storage.
No cold storage. I mean, there's still countries today that have no cold storage for beer.
Probably limited understanding of sanitation as well, right?
Well, no, like very little. You know, I mean, there's a brewing scientist named Paul Farnsworth that I think is still involved in the thing, and he tells of working in a brewery when he was a kid and in England, and the guy, they had a gauging stick that they would stick in the fermenter to see how much beer was in it. You know, it was marked off, and he said he reached for that stick and started to put it in the tank, and the guy goes, the brewer, supervising brewer, goes, no, and then you got to do this, and he put the stick under his arm and he pulled it out to wipe it off, and then he stuck it in the brewery.
Excellent.
So that lack of understanding of proper cleaning and
well, at least he knew it had to be cleaned, right?
At least he knew it kind of sort of had to be dusted off anyway. I always loved the story.
Well, let's get into what are some of the flavors that are characteristic of lager yeast?
Well, the first thing is about lager yeast is that biology moves slower at low temperatures.
Yeah.
Right. That's just a fundamental law. You know, we die if we get too cold, right? We're just like wired that way. But if you think about a lizard or a snake, the colder they are, the less they can move. Right. And when it's warm, they're up and moving about, hunting food, whatever. Mm-hmm. So yeast are the same way. So you know, yeast is like this little chemical factory. It's a little bag of goo that's got all these processes going on inside of it. Just like a mile a minute, it's making proteins and it's busting up, taking sugar rings and snipping them open and popping the little carbon units off to create some energy. And it's just like, it's storing waste in little sacks and it's just doing all kind of amazing stuff.
Pretty cool for a one cell creature, right?
Absolutely astonishing. And every one of these pathways has a whole bunch of different steps in it. And each of those steps has a certain chemicals associated with them. And some of those are very pleasant and desirable, and some of those are not. You know, there's a pathway called the Ehrlich pathway that starts with amino acids in the wort, and the way those amino acids are metabolized inside the cells leads to productions of very specific esters. So there's, you know, a handful of those amino acids like leucine and isoleucine and a number of those. And the specific amino acid mix in the wort will in part determine which esters you get. And of course there's esters, there's also, you know, there's aldehydes, there's, you know, a number of different chemicals, there's some sulfur compounds that are all present in yeast and fermentation in general.
And yeah, I was going to say most of these flavors that you're talking about, like esters and so on, the ales produce the same thing, right? They produce the same flavors. It's just they all produce it. Every yeast strain produces them in different quantities, right?
Well, that's what's really interesting. Yes, generally, that's true. And that's the way I had always thought about it.
Yeah.
But in researching this article, I ran across a paper where they were talking about that not only is the overall quantity of esters lower in lager yeast, as you would expect,
yeah,
but the spectrum of those esters tends to be somewhat different. And what they were saying was that that the esters that are present in beer tend to be smaller molecules. And there's a general tendency in flavor chemistry for, you know, you have esters and you have little tiny ones based on a single carbon unit, and you have two carbon unit ones, and you have them, you know, going up to 7, 8, 9 carbon units long. And when you go from like the shorter molecules tend to be, like with esters, the shorter molecules tend to be very fruity. And as you get into longer lengths, you get more like aged wine and a little bit of like cognac character and even a little bit kind of waxy, sort of waxy, oily kind of characteristics. And so with ale yeast, you get the full spectrum. But right. With lager yeast, you tend to focus on the ethyl acetate, which is sort of generally fruity, maybe a little bit of pear.
Yeah, it's kind of pear-like. It's small quantities. It's a nail polish remover if you get to extremes, I guess.
But almost anything will be like a nail polish remover if you get too much of it.
Yeah.
Because what's happening there with that one's a particularly instructive one because it's very common and it's not at all rare to have a beer that has that ester present at like 100 times more than a threshold value. And what's happening in there is it's really no longer a smell. It's a trigeminal sensation.
So right? it's a flavor basically, right?
No. A mouth.
It's a
but
what?
It's a mouthfeel technically, but it's going on in your nose, right? So you have these things called TRPA1 receptors. They're the mustard receptor. Right. Mm-hmm. So when you smell mustard and you get that spicy twang in your nose.
Yep.
That's a touch receptor actually, but they're sensitive to chemicals, and almost any smellable chemical in high enough amounts will create that sort of irritation.
Interesting.
Thing. And that's what that solventy thing is. Your eyes water, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what that's how I identify it because it stops smelling fruity. Because it's like now the trigeminal's just taken over. Because trigeminal system's basically a warning system.
Emergency system, right?
It's an emergency system, so it has very high traffic priority over just about everything else. And so, you know, you smell like that sort of fruity, and then it like you smell pear, but then you get to a certain point, and all you got is solvent, and your eyes are watering, and that's how you know. You know,
that's your body saying, don't drink this.
Well, you're out of range. You're out of range on your olfactory receptor.
Yeah.
Because they have a limited dynamic range. They can only smell between here and here.
That's right.
And above here, you can't really smell it anymore because they're not designed to work with that. They have that's another miracle of nature, how they manage to produce a much wider dynamic range overall than any one cell, like, you know, an order of magnitude. I mean, that's another discussion, but so you have ethyl acetate. That's a one carbon thing. You have amyl acetates like isoamyl acetate, and then alcohol similarly. So you'll have isoamyl alcohol, but that gives you pretty much that same kind of banana character that isoamyl acetate has.
Right.
And then there's
so you're going from pears to bananas, and then what's the third one?
Bananas, you got apples, you got pineapple, you know, you got ethyl butyrate, that's sort of apple-y, you got ethyl hexanoate, that's the apple-y one.
So now you're making more and more complicated molecule chains, right?
Yes. Well, yeah. just, yeah, more complicated, different. And the more, the longer the molecules are, the more different ways they can kind of branch out and have different side chains attached to different places. So you get this sort of explosion in the category as you get bigger, in terms of the molecular size. So,
but I guess, your main point is lagers tend to produce a lot of more of the simple ones or more of the complex? No, more of the complex ones. I'm sorry.
No, more of the simple esters.
Okay.
So more of those basic fruity esters. And honestly, if you think about, like, what's Budweiser famous for? Mm-hmm. In terms of their aroma profile, you know?
Yeah.
Apples.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? And the
that's true. A lot of American lagers are that way.
Yeah. But the scuttlebutt going around in the homebrew world years and years ago is that that was acetaldehyde. But a company like that wouldn't let a beer with acetaldehyde
out.
Yeah,
I can't imagine.
They know how to not do that. But it is ester, you know?
Yeah.
And then Coors is famously has a little hint of banana.
Hmm.
And what's really interesting is I talked to a guy named Greg Casey, who's a legendary brewing scientist who retired from Miller Coors in sometime in the last 5 or 10 years. And his son has a brewery called Casey Brewing Company out in the Denver area that he helps out with. But he studied the yeast back in the 90s, I think it was, and had basically categorized American lager yeast into two big groups. The Tuborg group and the Carlsberg group. It's not at all clear whether these correspond to the group one and group two categories, but there's a lot of similarities. But yeah, what he said,
we actually had Greg Casey on in about 5 or 6 episodes ago. I think it was 248.
Yeah,
and he was talking about he's doing a book series on American lager specifically.
Yeah, on the history of all that. So what he, you know, what's interesting is that he said two things about, like, pretty much all of the Tuborg, or I'm sorry, all of the Carlsberg strains are gone. Hmm. And, or they're not really gone, but those breweries are not successful.
Interesting.
You know, had basically had, like, Blatz and companies like that, that maybe, they're kind of maybe sometimes being revived or whatever, but they didn't go to dominate the world of beer. And it's, you know, if you study the history, there was a huge amount of money that went into the business when the cigarette company bought Miller.
Yeah.
And they just, like, upped the game with Anheuser-Busch, and they just went at it like mad and popped Schlitz out of action and a whole bunch of other things. So there's a lot of business reasons why those two companies dominated so much. But Casey, you know, raised the issue that a couple things. One is that Americans seem to prefer lager yeast that generate a little bit of esters, and that's a type 2 strain. Whereas the type 1 strain likes to ferment colder and produces fewer esters for a much more neutral type beer, much more malt focused and less estery beer. And that public taste preferred that. And also that those type 2 yeasts produce less sulfur.
Interesting.
And Americans in particular are kind of sulfur averse, whereas in Europe it's sort of regarded as a mark of quality. Now, in lager beer, you can get two kinds of sulfur. You can get sulfide and sulfite.
Yeah.
So sulfide is that sewer gas kind of nose.
Yeah. Obviously not rotten eggs desirable. Kind of thing, right?
Rotten eggs, exactly. And it's not that desirable of an aroma, but the good thing about it is it blows off pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And sulfite is basically the same thing as sulfited wine, you know?
Yeah, it's a preservative, basically. I use it even for mead making and stuff. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it has a smell of a burnt, like you strike a match and you get that pungent, like, flash of a certain characteristic.
Yeah. If you use it in high quantities, generally you use it fairly low quantities to keep, you know, just to keep wine preserved, for example.
Right. Yeah. But in a beer fermentation, sometimes you get that, you just get that little sharp.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Punch in the nose. Right. And it doesn't last very long either. But that sulfite does preserve the flavors of the beer and keeps them fresher long.
Right. It's a natural antioxidant, like, for example, exactly. But it also, like, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, I found that all a pretty interesting, you know, interesting discussion about that, which I don't know, you know, it just leads you to wonder, you know.
Well, fermentation temperature plays a critical role as well for most lager strains. How does the fermentation temperature affect the lager yeast?
Well, like I said, it's just really about about maintaining the proper fermentation temperature for what you're doing. Because if you want to make a lager and you decide you want to use a lager yeast, but you can't maintain a real accurate temperature control over your system, you're probably better off just using an ale and trying to keep it on the cool side.
I know people have experimented a lot with using lager yeast strains at relatively high temperature, low ale temperatures. I was thinking that the experiments from Brewlosophy, they did a number of experiments on this and found some interesting things. So, and they've had some success, but they did find, I think, that it's actually strain dependent. So there's only certain strains that work well at the higher temperatures.
Right. Well, I came across an interesting article about a lost yeast that's still in the yeast banks in the University of Munich, the technical university. So it's called the TUM, Technical University of Munich, TUM 35. And that's a strain that was very popular or somewhat popular in northern Bavaria in the 1950s. And everybody agreed it just made the most fabulous beer. But they had two bad years in barley growing there. And one year, I forget exactly what happened. One year, the barley over-ripened, and then another year, it was wet. And neither one really made a very good malt. For whatever reason, this yeast could not tolerate really out-of-spec yeast, and the beer was terrible.
Sorry, out-of-spec malt, I assume you meant.
Or out-of-spec malt, yeah. And so they just struggled with the flavors of these beers. And by the end of a couple of these years, everybody had just given up on this yeast. But it's recently they've propagated it. They sent it out, did some brewing trials with it. Somebody wrote an article about fermenting with it and making an IPA out of it and got great results in an IPA. So if that strain pops up, it finds itself as a special seasonal one-off yeast at White Labs or Y Yeast, I would recommend people get a hold of it and give it a try because it sounds pretty exciting. So there's little surprises out there. There's some things.
Always interesting things, yeah. Beyond the character of the strain itself, you also need to consider elements of the recipe, like the malt bill, the gravity, the attenuation, the balance. And these are, even as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, even highlighted more in a lager. How do these factors kind of play into the yeast performance and flavor?
Well, I think a lot of them are more performance and technical fermentation performance issues, let's call them. Every yeast has a proper temperature range, and unless you're just really hell-bent on trying something new, it's a good idea to stick with those ranges,
right,
for best results. And if you're brewing a classic Czech style pils, I would highly recommend getting your hands on a proper Bohemian strain. It seems like most of the As far as I can tell, again, this is difficult because the companies do not always identify them as type one or type two, but you want to get your hands on a proper Bohemian yeast, which is a type one yeast. And that really requires a lower fermentation than a type two yeast. And as such, I'm guessing it'll probably take a little bit longer, but that will give you more of the flavor profile you're looking for in a classic Czech pilsner.
I had Mitch Steele on last episode, and he started creating some good craft beer pilsners. But he mentioned, I think he had more success with the Weihsteffen variations. How are they? Are they any different?
Well, I mean, Weihsteffen is just there's Weihsteffen is both a brewery and a school.
Yeah.
Right, and so that TUM strains, that strain collection, that's the Weihsteffen collection. Mm-hmm. I think it's privately owned now, is what I heard.
Yeah, I think he mentioned he was using White Labs, I believe.
But there's the most famous lager strain strain out of that collection is called 3470.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think there were two, originally two, and then they realized they were the same thing or something. And then started calling, you know, 3470. So that's very, it's a workhorse. It's super robust. If you want to make a lager and you just don't want to screw around with the yeast or think about it, just get that one.
Yeah.
You know, if you're making a, there are yeasts, if you look at the catalogs, you know, I took White Yeast and White Labs catalogs, just copied and pasted them into my Word doc so I could kind of manipulate them and make notes. And they don't line up exactly precisely, but there's a lot of similarities in the yeah. categories. And I'm sure whoever else is selling yeast, it's going to be along similar lines. If you're making a dark beer, there are yeasts that are recommended for that, strains that enhance the maltiness. If you're making a hoppy one, there seems like there was one or two that kind of said, yeah, this is pretty good for a hoppy pilsner. If you're making a strong beer, you definitely want to have a lager yeast that is up to that, you know, that can handle that. There's actually a strain designed to work at warmer temperatures. So if you're trying to make a lager and you really are struggling, you don't have a dedicated fridge, and you're trying to do it in your basement with like wet cloths or some of those Kluge solutions, then there's a slightly warm temperature one. There's the California steam beer yeast, but I wouldn't recommend that. They don't recommend it to make proper lagers with. And then
that's more of a hybrid, if I believe, right?
I'm not sure what the yeast is.
Yeah.
I've never seen any data on that, so I couldn't tell you that. But then, let's see, what's the third thing? Oh, there's also a lager yeast that's designed to make lager very fast. So if you're in a hurry, you got a wedding coming up, and you're brewing beer for it, and they want a lager, I would run out and get that.
So, what are any
special thing? You can just look and see what they've got and pick that one.
I mean, what are some of the considerations you look at when you're picking the correct lager yeast for a given beer?
Honestly, you know, because we're not a dedicated lager brewing company, we have tended to stick with more
with the style.
We stick with the workhorse strain, unless we have a particular need. If we're doing something super malty, which we don't really do very much, because honestly, it's really hard to get people to drink dark beer these days, unfortunately.
Yeah.
At least around our parts.
Not me. I like dark beer.
I love dark beer. Our brewers love dark beer, but we brew one and put one on, and it stays around twice as long as anything else. So,
yeah.
You know, we like to do them occasionally. We've had really good market results with a Vienna lager with a little bit of oak infused into it. And so that's our we call it Hoodie Weather. That's our fall beer and at Forbidden Root. So, you know, I don't know. Everything changes. So, you know, I do see a little more dark beer out in the market. I see people kind of enthusiastic about black lagers and things like that. So, you know, maybe the IPA thing will no longer continue to grow and grow and grow till it snuffs everything else out.
But yeah,
we'll see.
Well, a lot of craft breweries have started making high quality lagers, like pilsners. And sure. I personally enjoy going into a craft brewery and sampling their pilsner. It gives a good indication of how the brewery as a whole is doing. But what's been your experience the last few years making you know, good quality lagers in your two breweries?
Well, one experience we had is at Five Rabbit. We had a beer called a Super Pils. Mm-hmm. And we were fermenting that with an English ale strain. That's a very neutral strain that can tolerate cool temperatures. So we were doing about a week fermentation and then a 3-week cold conditioning on that beer. And we went along that way happily for years. And then our brewer just thought, well, you know, I wonder, we got a little bit of extra tank time here. I wonder what would happen if we switch this over to a lager. So he brewed a batch and, you know, we sat down and we tried the two beers side by side, and it was interesting. I can't really say one was better than the other, but and the best way I can really describe it is that when we tasted the lager yeast compared to the ale at a cool temperature, we just felt like a little bit of a veil had been lifted.
Interesting.
It wasn't anything you could really put your fingers on. We weren't really smelling the esters in the super pills before. And this was a 7% alcohol, 60 IBU beer. So it was a little, out of spec. It was kind of not quite an imperial pilsner, but it was a stronger pilsner type of. We were using a Heidelberger malt, just super pale, very grassy kind of malt. It's important when you're thinking about lagers to keep in mind that there are two things about lagers that make them separate from ales. And one is obviously the fermentation process and the yeast that's used, but probably more visible, more tasteable, really more important, I think, is that there are specific recipes that are come out of lager beer culture in Bohemia and Bavaria, like the Pilsner, the Helles, the Dortmunder, the Oktoberfest beers, that whole spectrum.
Sure.
Each one of them has very specific malts that were associated with them. Now, you can brew a Vienna lager with crystal malt and American pale or American lager malt, but it's not really going to taste that much like an Oktoberfest, no matter what kind of yeast you use.
Right.
So it's really important to understand those flavors of the malts and how they're kilned and why they produce the flavors that they do and understand the differences. And, this gets to be a challenge with commercial brewing when you're trying to scale up and you're moving to, you're at a scale where you're using a malt in a silo, and that silo malt is way, way, way cheaper than the bag malt. And so, you have to really be careful about how you do your recipes. Usually people will have one or maybe two silos, and it's a limited range of stuff to work with. So the recipes get jiggered around. And of course, as homebrewers, you could pick whatever you want. You can use really expensive malt. It's not that costly.
Yeah.
But it's to be much more complicated decisions when you're brewing it at a commercial scale at 30, 40, 60, 100 barrels. It gets like things you would really like to do. It's just like, is this really worth double the price of malt for this beer? Is it that important? Can we support that price in the finished product? Can we get that extra buck a case or whatever it happens to be,
One nice thing with home brewing is you usually don't have to worry that much about how much it costs because you're just not trying to really turn a profit, but. But so lagers, they can be very difficult to brew because any flaws are going to shine through. Have you got any advice for homebrewers trying to create the perfect lager?
Not really. recipes are simplicity themselves if you want to be historic about it.
Yeah.
Because every town had their own malt, right? And if you look at those old books from the 1800s, there's hardly a recipe in any of them. Because if you're in Munich, you're going to use Munich malt.
Yeah, it was brewing local back then, obviously.
It was just local and it wasn't like, and then you get to around 1900 and you start to see maybe some recipes that'll do two or three different approaches to doing a Vienna and, with different amounts of Munich and Pils malt and Vienna malt or some things like that. And people are starting to kind of think about it that way. But to my mind, the best Vienna is just pure Vienna malt. And you get that really rich, caramelly kind of thing. There's nothing magic about sanitation and cleaning. Those are different things, and you need to do them both. Mm-hmm. You need to get proper
Right, proper you already mentioned temperature control, very important. Yeah.
Temperatures, yeah. I mean, if you want to make lagers, you just got to get extra refrigerator or a chest freezer with a setback, something, because you just can't do them in your basement.
Yeah.
I mean, you do something, you can do lots of stuff, but you can't really make proper lagers. So you really got to be careful about that. You can't tell them what to do. So, get nail that recipe, keep it simple. Like, I remember Ray Daniels and I talking to a brewer who had come to one of our Siebel classes, and she had a recipe for a Vienna or an Oktoberfest beer, and there were like a dozen ingredients in it. And we looked at it, and it's like, what is all this stuff? She said, well, I inherited the recipe, and then I added some stuff. It's like, well, what are you trying to do here? Like, what do you want the outcome to be? You know, and like that's in a commercial brewery, that's what I always start with is like that label copy.
Yeah.
You know, this rich golden ale, blah, 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 you know, and then you know, like everything about how you formulate the recipe, about the brewing process on brew day, about fermentation, about finishing, everything should always come back and have a reason
that's,
to achieve your flavor goal.
When I do my recipe design course, that's usually the first slide I put up is, you know, have some idea what you're trying to accomplish here.
Have a plan because you can't, I mean, you can make a recipe by just like, oh, here's some dark malt, I'll throw that in. Here's some pale, I'll throw that in. You know, but you're not going to learn anything. Yeah. You know, you're not going to really be able to develop into a proper brewer unless you're super deliberate about everything. You know, and I think that's the biggest lesson because people get so hung up on the technical details sometimes or just excited about the possibilities. And they sometimes are just not used to starting the process with the end goal firmly in envisioned. You know, you gotta picture yourself drinking it, gotta see it in the glass. You gotta really like figure out what it is you want to do, and then you figure out how to make it happen. I think that's the biggest piece of advice I could give to anybody. I've said that for years, and it's still, and it's always true.
Yeah. Well, in your at the end of your article, you talk a little bit about the future of lager yeast. So I thought I'd give you a minute here at the end to talk about where you think lager yeasts are going. And, you know, lagers are starting to see increased popularity at the craft brewing level.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Pilsner, you mentioned the Pilsner as a kind of standard. It really is a brewer's beer. You know, every brewer I know really loves a good Pilsner. You know, and that's just because it's just a thing of wonder. It's naked malt.
It's a beautiful thing.
That combination of malt and hops. It's just spectacular. And it doesn't mean there isn't ways to make different versions of that and be creative within a narrow style box. So I don't know where I was going with that.
Well, you were talking about the future of lager yeast.
Yeah, it's the future of lager. So I think it's great to see. It's great to see lager in the mix. You know, we have a brewery here in Chicago called Metropolitan that's all lagers, and they do a great job. We have another brewery called Dovetail that does lagers and wild barrel aged beers, which is kind of an odd mix, but they're doing some cool things. And so you know, I love having those good quality lagers available. Because honestly, the ones you get imported are not worth drinking, in my opinion. Even a fast-moving brand like Heineken, those beers are 6 weeks, 8 weeks old at least by the time they land in a store over here.
Yeah,
you know, just that's like a month is sort of where they really start to turn. You know, we always thought on our golden ale that was, again, a fairly cool fermented. It was kind of like, if you didn't really know, you'd think it was a lager. But about 4 to 6 weeks, and that beer is like, yeah, we like the new batch better. Yeah. You know, it wasn't like it was gone bad, but there's something really, really amazing about drinking super fresh beer, and it applies to those pale lagers more than anything else. So, you know, the future, no one really knows, but there's some fun stuff. I mean, they've got this Saccharomyces bionis, and they have a bunch of different strains of that, and they've been doing brewing trials, and they're finding that it'll like a type 2 yeast, it will ferment maltotriose or maltotriose, I don't know how they actually pronounce it, but that it's that 3-unit sugar that is in malt, and it will actually ferment that, which is sort of like, you know, the popular lager strain. That's another difference, by the way, between the type 1 and type 2 is that the type 2 can ferment that sugar so that the finished beer is a little more dry, a little more attenuated, and a little more alcohol per the amount of grain you put in.
Cool.
Right? So producers like that from the point that if they're shooting for 4.8%, they can get away with maybe, I don't know, 5-10% less malt in the mix. you know, and that makes the brewing accountants happy. So they've got all these different Sac Biana strains, and some of them are actually POF negative, which is that phenol off flavor, right? That's a real common trait in wild yeast. So, but it's also obviously popular in Belgium and with Hefeweizen and yeast and things like that to have that POF gene in there. But some of those don't have that. So that means there's some Saccharomyces Biana strains that actually should make pretty good beer. And what I read in the trials, it sounds like maybe they are. So that'll be another one to look for. And there are also people like forcing different yeast strains to breed together. So they're looking at creating new Saccharomyces and Sac Biana strains to create lager yeast that maybe produce a little bit more esters.
Interesting.
You know, like which that like more esters, but still that clean ester. You know, those simple fruity esters rather than the more complex wine-like,
right,
waxy, oily kind of esters that are common in ale fermentation. So that would be something else to look for is some of these new hybrids. I haven't heard of any of them really reaching commercial production, but there's that. Like you mentioned, the sour strains; those are interesting.
Yeah.
Although we've tried a few of them, and they're not very easy to control the amount of sourness. You kind of get what you get, and so if you're trying to make a beer, trying to really finely balance the acidity in a particular beer,
right?
Like you wouldn't want the same amount of acidity in a pear beer that you would want in a cherry beer, for example.
Right. Yeah. You got to offset the sweetness, right?
Well, you get too much sourness, and your brain doesn't read it as pear because pear doesn't have that much acidity.
Right.
You know, so there's a mismatch there, and your brain just kicks it out, right? The illusion goes away. So that'd be another one to look at. They're also trying to make strains, make hybrids between Saccharomyces and some of the other cold tolerant strains. They recently found a cold tolerant strain living in beech trees, of all things. And that one sounds like it has some promise also.
Wow.
So, you know,
a lot of cool new stuff coming up, right?
Yeah. And if you're super geeky and, you know, have an interest in working with enzymes, there are specific protease enzymes that people are experimenting with adding to mashes to create that amino acid profile in the wort that will emphasize production of one type of ester over another.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's very complicated.
I think
it would probably take a while to get that sorted out. But for a big brewery like AB or Coors, you know, Miller Coors, where they really have a particular thing they're trying to do, and, you know, they might be able to figure out just slight changes in the mashing process, you know, because enzymes, you don't use a lot of them, so the cost is probably not going to be a huge issue, but it might make some changes to fermentation that would be desirable from a consumer flavor standpoint, you know, as audiences evolve, you know, like they change those beers to match what's acceptable to consumers in a way that's very subtle, and we don't really notice changes as they go along. If you remember, AB was at, like Budweiser was at 6 or 7 BUs, and about 10, 15 years ago, there were reports that they had bumped that up to like 11, you know, because people were starting to be less put off by bitterness, having had a little experience with craft. So that beer basically ramped that up. So
cool. There's
all these, you know, all those big companies, there's all this subtle stuff in the background that they're always kind of making sure that we're still, this is still good, still good. You like this, you know?
Well, I do look forward to trying some of those, Randy, but unfortunately we are running out of time. But hey, I really appreciate you coming on the show today and talking to us a little bit about lager yeast.
Sure. It's my pleasure.
My guest today was Randy Mosher, author of Mastering Homebrew, Radical Brewing and Tasting Beer, and also a partner at Five Rabbit and Forbidden Root Breweries in Chicago. Thank you again, Randy.
Yeah. Thank you, Brad. See you next time.
A big thank you to Randy Mosher for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also The Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And the web-based version of Beersmith is available now with the new inventory module at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. You can try Beersmith Web for 30 days for free by setting up an account at BeersmithRecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get both Beersmith Web and the desktop version of Beersmith for one low price. Check out BeersmithRecipes.com today to give it a try. I'd like to thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.